This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This afternoon in New Jersey, the Cleveland Cavaliers will try to win their seventh consecutive playoff game, up 2-0 in their second-round series against the Nets. Cleveland swept Washington in round one. Less flashy and less consistently successful than the Suns and the Spurs during the regular season, the Cavs appear to have discovered how well they can play when it's most important to do so, unless all this success has come about simply because Cleveland is still facing other Eastern Conference teams. Joining me now to help determine how far the Cavs can go is Terry Pluto, sports columnist for the Akron Beacon Journal. Terry, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hello, Bill.
To what do you attribute the postseason success of the Cavs to this point?
I mean, first you have to start with the fact that they did have the second-best record in the Eastern Conference, and they're playing teams in the Eastern Conference. So it should be expected they would play well. Secondly, they have a tremendous player in LeBron James, even though the NBA decided that people voting did not put him on the first All-NBA team, which is, to me, just baffling. The guy averaged 27 points, 6 rebounds, and 6 assists for the second consecutive year. Only Oscar Robertson's ever done that in NBA history. And when you have a great player and you have a team like the Cavaliers that are one of the top rebounding teams in the league, and you're playing in a conference, the East, which, let's face it, is not anywhere close to being as strong as the West, the Cavs should be flexing their muscles, and I'm not sure they should run through the first two rounds without losing a game, but they ought to be rolling over some people, and so far they've been able to do that.
In Wednesday's column, you referred to the Cavs as, quote, quietly the hottest team in basketball. How can a team toil in anonymity with LeBron James on the roster?
Hey, if you spend enough time in Cleveland, you'll notice how you can get ignored. I mean, it's just a fact. I mean, Bill, you could say LeBron James, the guy's made over $100 million with the Nike and the big selling shoes and everything else. But I'll tell you, part of the problem with this is I think while LeBron James is a flashy player, he's a very kind of polite, well-spoken young guy, at least when they see him in front of the microphones and everything. You know, he's not particularly colorful off the court.
Mm-hmm.
When people come to do him, they sort of do stories on him. They don't come away with exactly what they wanted. I mean, just almost in the same way Grady Sizemore, who made the cover of Sports Illustrated, we're all holding our breath on that one, with the Indians, is another type of star like that, a young guy who's pretty well-spoken. But also, it's Cleveland. We're supposed to be ignored.
Since he has been in the league, there's been speculation about how quickly LeBron James would mature into mm-hmm. the kind of player who could carry a team all the way to a championship. Is it too early to speculate that time may have come?
Well, right now, if you were to compare him to Jordan in year four, Michael Jordan in year four had finally won a playoff series, and he really didn't have much going at all in Chicago at that point. People forget it took 7 years for the Bulls to win a title with Jordan. He came into a bad situation like Cleveland in the same way LeBron. He's now on his third coach. You know, they've gone through different players. But he won a playoff series last year. They took Detroit to 7 games in the Eastern Conference semifinals. I believe they're going to end up getting through this series with New Jersey. I think they'll play Detroit. I think it's going to be a heck of a series in the Eastern Conference finals in his fourth year. So, to me, he's moving along in the right direction, and he's doing it. Nobody else on the Cavaliers team is being voted to anything, not all defense, offense, all obscure, nothing.
Well, let's talk about some of these other guys, though. Do some of them at least deserve some credit for the rise of the Cavaliers?
Sure they do. The Cavs didn't get to be second in the league in rebounding just because of LeBron James. I mean, they have a 7'3" center, and it's Adrenas Ilgauskas. He's probably a top 10 to 12 in the league. And he tries to get rebounds. They have a guy named Drew Gooden who is desperately trying to learn how to be like Horace Grant or Carlos Boozer, just get a bunch of rebounds and score some when it comes your way. It's taken to an extent. I mean, you look at it, the last 2 years, Bill, they've won exactly 50 games.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're up going into tonight's game 2-0 on New Jersey. I mean, it's hard to say that this team has got big problems. If anything, in fact, if you have any context at all of Cleveland Cavaliers basketball, since 1970, the Cavs have been playing in the NBA, but they've never played in an NBA Finals. Never. They've only reached the Eastern Conference Finals twice.
let's assume that they beat the Nets. What has to happen for them to beat the Pistons? Can LeBron just perform magnificently, or do several other players have to play over their heads?
He's going to need a lot of help. And having watched Detroit some, I mean, they are a team that knows they only have another year or two together where they can really win a title. And, boy, are they locked in. And what they've done to Chicago Bulls, if you're a Cavs fan or player, that's going to get your attention. It could be even a little frightening. That's going to be difficult for them because I think in many ways Detroit, even though their regular season record wasn't as good, they're a better playoff team right now than a year ago because they added Chris Webber at midseason. And they present all kinds of problems for you defensively. And man, oh man, do they play good defense on their own. I mean, they're just a bunch of tough veteran guys. And the Cavs are probably lacking one or two of those type of players to get past Detroit. But I would not be shocked if they took them six games or seven games or something like that. I think they'll play them tough.
Well, it sounds, Terry, as if you will be happily surprised, if not altogether astonished, if the Cavaliers get the opportunity this season to play for the coveted Larry O'Brien Trophy.
I think you'd probably have to pull me off the floor with smelling salts. And it's not a knock on the team, but I've been around the NBA a long time, Bill, and written a number of books about it and everything, and that's a long way of saying this league is pretty unforgiving. Not too many teams get to the finals without having paid their dues in the playoffs. This is only the second year in the playoffs for LeBron. It always takes a long time to get there.
Terry Pluto is a sports columnist for the Akron Beacon Journal, and he joins me from time to time on Only a Game. Terry, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
Detroit owns a one-game-to-none lead over Anaheim in the NHL's Western Conference Finals. The mere presence of the expansion Ducks in a late postseason series against an original six squad may torque off hockey traditionalists, but as Jane Lindholm reports, the otherwise migratory waterfowl have settled nicely on their frozen pond in Anaheim, and they plan to stay there.
The Mighty Ducks first entered the national consciousness as the children's hockey team coached by Emilio Estevez in the eponymous Walt Disney movie of 1992. When it came to marketing the Mighty Ducks franchise, the House of Mouse saw more than home videos and sequels. It went so far as to create its own real-life National Hockey League team, named, you guessed it, the Mighty Ducks. Disneyland's in Anaheim, California, about 30 miles south of downtown Los Angeles. The Mighty Ducks were born there in 1993, and there they've stayed. But Disney apparently got sick of non-fictionalized sports. The company had already sold its controlling interest in the Angels, Anaheim's American League baseball team, and in 2005 it sold the Mighty Ducks to local investors and philanthropists Henry and Susan Samueli. The ownership shuffle doesn't seem to have fazed the team much. The Ducks are currently facing off against the Detroit Red Wings in the semifinals of the Stanley Cup playoffs. But the changes may have helped the city of Anaheim. Mayor Kurt Pringle thinks so.
Disney's a smart company, and Disney knows how to draw and promote people to its product. But part of the ownership of professional sports teams is there has to be an emotional connection to that team. So in this case, I certainly see the value of having an individual owner who has a certain level of passion personally in the sport.
That kind of personal connection is something both the city and the team are banking on. The Ducks have been selling out their playoff games and have consistently drawn near-capacity crowds to their regular season games as well. Anaheim's attendance rate is a healthy 95%. The Honda Center, where the Ducks play, is owned by the city, but run by the Samueli's management company. Hockey writer Lyle Spector Richardson says when you compare Ducks' attendance with that of other NHL teams, the Ducks are coming out on top.
Anaheim is actually outdrawing traditional hockey cities like Boston and Chicago. But they're also outdrawing the New Jersey Devils, perennially one of the better teams in the National Hockey League. So they're even actually outdrawing the team that actually defeated them in the 2003 Stanley Cup Finals.
Of course, winning helps attract fans and celebrities. This year's playoff success has drawn characters usually seen in nearby Los Angeles. Snoop Dogg attended a recent playoff game. Waving an orange foam finger, he chatted with the FSN sportscasters in between periods.
He's here to see his first hockey game.
Yabba dabba dizzle, whishizzle dizzle.
See, that's what I'm talking about. All right, what are you doing here? You were telling me it's your very first hockey game.
Yeah, my youngest son, he said, Daddy, take me to a hockey game. I like watching hockey, so I brought him to a game. It's right down the street from my house. We love Anaheim. We love the Mighty Ducks. I'm just here to support him. Go, Mighty Ducks. Go, go, go.
Writer Lyle Richardson says high-profile fans like Snoop are going to draw even more people to the team.
He obviously enjoyed what he saw, and that definitely came across in the interview that he gave, and that wound up flying all over the internet. And if they can get celebrities who can come out and support the team, or at least verbally or whatever, come out and support the team, that's only going to help them even more.
A strong association with Anaheim is also helping the team, which officially changed its name this season from the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim to the Anaheim Ducks. That's in stark contrast to the other big athletic draw in town, the Angels baseball team. That team used to be called the Anaheim Angels. Now they go by the long-winded moniker, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Mayor Kurt Pringle says that hurts.
We continue to be very disappointed that the Angels decide to promote a neighboring county and a neighboring city, as we continue to feel in violation of the city's lease because they play in a city building. But we won't talk about that. What we'll talk about, though, is the Ducks felt it would be best to put Anaheim up front. And I think it really does show the difference in the ownership and having a local team that really sees the value of promoting the local community, and the building stays pretty full because of it.
And local sports bars, which fill up with Ducks fans on game days, have benefited as well. At the ESPN Zone right next to Disneyland, Frank Coral and his teenage son Nick stood in front of the bar's giant screen TV in full Ducks regalia as Anaheim played Vancouver in the second round.
It's our own team. We can associate with it. It's our team. We're not Los Angeles, and we don't like to be associated with Los Angeles. I don't appreciate what the Angels have done. In fact, I've lost respect for the Angels' ownership since they've changed names.
And Anaheim Mayor Kurt Pringle is hoping that the Ducks' success, combined with the city's high-income residents and big tourist attractions like Disneyland, will be enough to draw more sports fans to the area.
Basketball would be a great complement to what's happening in Anaheim.
Stay tuned for a fight over that team's name. Anyone up for the Anaheim Seven Dwarves of Anaheim? For Only a Game, I'm Jane Lindholm in Anaheim, California.
Where we each play a part. The miracle of imagination. The marvels of earth, sea, and sky. These wonders untold are ours to behold in the funny world. The sunny world. The wonderful world of color.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, keeping one's eye on the birdie and then leaping up and smashing it. But first, in order to discuss a change in the culture of the clubhouse and various other baseball matters, Tim Kirkjian of ESPN joins me. Tim, welcome back.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. St. Louis Cardinals pitcher Josh Hancock died in an automobile accident on April the 29th. He was intoxicated when he drove his car into the back of a parked truck. Now, several teams, including the Cardinals, have said that they will no longer make beer available in the clubhouse after ball games. Good idea?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I mean, did Josh Hancock die because he was drinking in the clubhouse? Absolutely not. Should he have been? Obviously, way more responsible than this. Obviously, he should have been. These are grown men. It's up to them to take care of things and do things the right way. And taking beer out of the clubhouse, I'm not sure, is really going to solve any problems here. But at least you're trying to make sure this never happens again. So this would be a much different story, Bill, if it were 20 years ago when, trust me, covering the game, guys used to sit around for hours after the game drinking beer, talking about baseball. They don't do that anymore. They're too rich and they're too famous and they have too many places to go. They're not sitting around anymore drinking beer and talking about the game. So it's not as big a deal, and since it isn't that big a deal, you might as well ban it and tell them, look, go drink somewhere else and don't do it on our time.
And then the question is, of course, can baseball do any more to eliminate players going out and drinking in several bars after the game and then climbing into their cars?
Well, again, I think all you got to do is tell them, look, one of your brethren died after doing this. If that's not enough, I don't know what else you can do. Again, we're talking about, Bill, we've got 44-year-old players in the major leagues, okay? To tell them, here's how you have to live your life. If you don't know it by now, then you just haven't been watching. And I don't think we need to do anything beyond making sure there isn't a keg in the clubhouse for guys to drink so they can drive home drunk. It's not working that way anyway. People aren't doing that now, but just to make sure, it's probably a good idea.
Among the teams announcing that they will not eliminate beer in the clubhouse is the Milwaukee Brewers. Do circumstances there, beginning with the name of the team, provide an example of how hard it is to separate beer from the culture of the Major League game?
Well, again, Bill, I mean, how many times do we talk about, why don't we go to the game tonight, have a dog and a beer? I mean, it's a tradition in baseball. And, you know, the Milwaukee Brewers, I mean, they're in a very difficult spot here. I don't blame them for not banning, you know, beer from the clubhouse. But Chris Capuano, is their player rep, basically said, look, you know, we don't sit around drinking all day, all right? People might think we are, but we're not. So I don't think we should ban it because nobody's abusing it anyway. And I think he has every right to stand up here. So I think it's a team-by-team policy. Whatever team goes for it is okay with me. Let's just all be a little bit more responsible about this.
Will Roger Clemens pitch forever, or will he stop once he has all the money in the world?
Well, he's already got all the money in the world. This latest contract will make sure of that, Bill. He's getting $1 million per start.
Good bucks.
And he gets everything else that he wants. Just another sign of what Frank Robinson told me last year when I said, Frank, the players think they're in charge. And he said, think they're in charge? They are in charge. And that's why Roger Clemens got the deal that he got. I think he will pitch this year for the Yankees. I think he will pitch very well. He will not pitch as well as he did in the National League Central, which is a completely different ball game than pitching in the American League East, where hitters are everywhere and there's a designated hitter. But given how desperate the Yankees were, this was something they had to do. And Clemens caught the perfect storm. Three teams after him, one with the most money, being the most desperate. It couldn't have worked out better for him.
Well, it couldn't have, at least at this point. But you know and I know that baseball is a sport in which a player can wake up some morning and suddenly discover that it's all gone. Has Mr. Steinbrenner really invested wisely here?
Yes, I think he has. I mean, has he overpaid terribly on this? Of course he has, Bill. That's ridiculous to give a man $18 million who's, you know, for 18 starts and he's 44 years old. But the critical point here is that the Yankees have that kind of money to spend, believe it or not. And it's like J.P. Ricciardi of the Blue Jays told me this spring, the Yankees and the Red Sox business is winning. That's it. A lot of other teams' business is trying to make money and doing other things within the organization. The Yankees and the Red Sox have to win for their business, and that's why this might not be a bad business decision, assuming, of course, the Yankees win again. Now, if they play poorly and they finish in fourth place and Roger Clemens is not very good anymore and they're paying him $1 million per start, wait till you see the criticism of the Yankees in August of this year. It will be relentless.
Tim, we ought to talk a little more about on-the-field developments this spring. What are the aforementioned Milwaukee Brewers doing in first place?
Well, they're a pretty good team, and they're in a really bad division, so that's a really good start for them. They have young players, Bill, everywhere, and they did it in a very, very good way, bringing them to the big leagues, knowing some of them would struggle, but they all knew, especially General Manager Doug Melvin, that by 2008, maybe even 2007, a lot of these young guys will have figured it out together. They came up together, they came to the big leagues together, and now they're starring in the big leagues together. Now, they still have a long way to go, but at this point, they are the clear favorite now to win the National League Central, and I don't think a whole lot of people saw that at the beginning of the year.
Tim, the Braves seem to have righted themselves. Detroit is playing well as I look at the standings. Any surprises, or are things playing out pretty much as they could have been predicted to play out?
Well, the Brewers are a surprise. To me, the Indians are a bit of a surprise, even though I acknowledged at the beginning of the year they could win 90 games this year. They were good. But they've had a lot of issues with injuries, bullpen problems, terrible weather, and yet, you know, they're right there in the American League Central, as will four teams, I believe, by the end of the season. So that AL Central, which used to be a joke, is now the best division in baseball, and it's a cyclical thing, but this is their year to be really good together, and I fully expect four teams to be in contention from that division.
Well, if the AL Central is now the best division in baseball, does that mean Boston's multi-game lead in the AL East is meaningless?
No, absolutely not. In fact, we just learned this last night, Bill. The Brewers and the Red Sox, this is the earliest in the history of baseball that two teams that had a seven-game lead this early in a season. So it just shows you, these teams that are pulling away early like this, this is unusual to say the least. The Red Sox are better than they were last year, Bill, and the collapse that they suffered and started in July last year, that is not going to happen this year because their starting rotation is much better. I think their offense is better than it was last year, but if anybody thinks the Yankees are just going to go away and die this year, they just haven't been watching the last 12 years because the Yankees make the playoffs every year.
Tim Kirchen of ESPN joins me from time to time to talk about baseball. Thank you, Tim.
My pleasure, Bill.
A week ago yesterday afternoon at MIT's DuPont Gym in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the 11th annual Boston Open Badminton Tournament's first dozen or so matches were noisily getting underway. The gallery was pretty much limited to the competitors' families and players waiting to take their turns on the court. In the first row of the bleacher sat 15-year-old Jen Perry, who started playing badminton when she was 10. She has not yet specialized as an athlete, but she's got some compelling reasons to keep whacking the shuttlecock.
I also play field hockey and lacrosse, and you just don't get to meet as many people in other sports as you do when you play badminton. We've been to Canada a few times. We've gone to Peru twice. We go to California a lot on the weekends to play tournaments there, Louisiana, Washington. We pretty much go everywhere that there's tournaments.
When she isn't globetrotting, Jen Perry plays her badminton in Marblehead, Massachusetts, at a club called Gut and Feathers. Gut being the strings of the badminton racket, feathers, in this case goose feathers, being a critical component of the birdie one bashes with the gut. In Marblehead, Melinda Caste coaches Perry, among many other players, young and old. A former international competitor who has represented her native Hungary and the U.S. at the elite level, Caste can tell pretty quickly whether a child hacking around on a badminton court has any aptitude for the game.
Usually when we give a kid a racket to their hands, you could see right away if they have any idea how to hold it, or they hold it with two hands, or they think it's very heavy. We like very athletic kids, but you also have to have a good eye on the court to be able to make quick decisions.
Beyond all that, Coach Caste says it's no good trying to succeed at badminton if you approach the game the way John McEnroe approaches tennis.
It's a very calm sport. Like, you really have to...
Calm sport.
Well, you cannot show emotions, really, and then you have to be... I always tell the kids, you try to be good actors or actresses, because even if you're upset, you can show it to your opponent. If you... getting upset, you usually lose the next point. You know, it's a very fast game. It's a very... short game.
The brand of badminton being played last weekend at the Boston Open was certainly fast, and in the first rounds, lots of the games were short. The most proficient players mixed leaping smashes with feathery drop shots that fell over the net like, well, dead birdies. The less proficient players were often left gasping for breath with their hands on their knees. By Sunday, when the finals of each of the tournament's five divisions were being contested, only very good players remained. One of the more exciting and noisier matches saw Angeline DePaul and Mona Santoso playing Zhu Hun Li and Yun Peng for the women's doubles title. Angeline DePaul, a native of Indonesia, plays badminton as loudly as Monica Seles used to play tennis. Her taller partner, Mona Santoso, seems to cover the court effortlessly. After they captured the women's doubles title, DePaul explained her vocal style.
Just the excitement and maybe communication also. Because if I didn't do like this, maybe I'm going to be nervous.
Angeline DePaul, now a top international player, has been playing badminton since she was 11, which she maintains initially put her at a disadvantage.
Late start, for if you're going to be a professional player, that must be late. Yeah, if you're going to be play for fun, it's okay.
DePaul is a professional. She and her partner each pocketed $900 for winning Sunday's final. The Boston Open distributed a total of $17,000 in prize money, which makes it one of the sport's more lucrative tournaments. Of course, in badminton, lucrative is a relative term.
2 or 3 weeks ago, I played international tournaments in Peru and Miami, and I won those, and there wasn't any prize money at all.
That's Michael Barras, the Canadian champion, who came into the Boston Open ranked third in the singles draw and first in mixed doubles. In the latter event, he and his partner, Valerie Loker, were upset in the quarterfinals. It was a surprising result for Barras, who's made his badminton reputation as a doubles and mixed doubles player, and the loss ratcheted up the pressure for the men's singles final, in which Barras met Raju Rai. Michael Barras prevailed in a close match, after which I asked him if he'd been aware of the way the excitement of the crowd, which numbered perhaps 400, had swelled the longer the points had gone on.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's always fun to play those rallies to see who's going to crack first and go for something that they shouldn't. And when they do go for it, is it going to pay off or are they going to make a risky mistake? And so when those rallies start to get long, you start to feel it, and you have to remember that he's feeling it just as much.
For his win, Mike Barras earned $1,400, enough certainly to cover the weekend's meals and get him back home to Ottawa in style. Raju Rai, the runner-up, was philosophical about the result. He's still recovering from a knee injury. For that and various other reasons, he couldn't feel too bad about finishing second to Barras.
Oh yeah, definitely. Mike's a good guy, and we've been friends for years now, so it's a friendly match, even though the trophy's on the line, but we're just out there to have a good time and give the crowd the best game that we can.
Relatively unusual match in the sense that not only were trophies on the line, there was money on the line. What's the difference between first and second place in this tournament?
Just a little $700. But it's a lot, you know. I wish I could have came out on top today, but, you know, Mike really played well, and I guess I got to hassle him for dinner tonight or something.
The next top-flight badminton tournament, the Pan American Championships, will begin Monday in Calgary. Later this summer, the U.S. Open in Orange, California, will feature a fortune in prize money by badminton standards, $50,000. You're listening to Only a Game. Simon Gibbons, who listens to Only a Game via onlyagame.org, emailed this week with a reminder of my gaffe of several weeks ago. He wrote that he could understand my trepidation in saying anything about the Cricket World Cup, since I'd declared Australia the winner 2 weeks before the event ended, but he felt we should acknowledge that Australia actually did win the tournament, quote, in contrast to your usual track record in picking winners. And speaking of winners, Justin Norfleet, who hears the program on WRVO in upstate New York, listened carefully enough last week to hear our Kentucky Derby analyst, Louisville Courier-Journal columnist Jenny Reese, pick Street Sense. I started to feel bad for her as I realized how far back in the pack Street Sense was, Mr. Norfleet wrote. But then something amazing happened. Street Sense made the move, and I got excited over a sport I don't even follow. You and your guests really know your stuff. Thanks for helping make my day. You rock. Take that, Mr. Gibbons. After hearing the story about the decreasing number of black baseball players at traditionally black colleges, Paul Fazio of Keene, New Hampshire, wrote, "When will there be a story about the lack of white basketball players and the disparity in scholarships offered to black athletes? Your stories have no credibility, nor are you doing society any good when all you harp on is one strand of a story." And finally, from Avon, Minnesota, a listener calling him or herself Diener emailed as follows. So, this morning, Bill Littlefield comes on at 6 sharp, and as soon as the show starts, a squirrel crawls down the trunk of the tree in my yard and perches on a branch just outside my window. He sits there the whole show, snoozing, looking around, occasionally flicking his tail. When the credits roll, he snaps to and scampers up the tree. I wonder if he is there every Saturday. And so, apparently, we have some credibility among squirrels, or with one squirrel, maybe. You can send your comments to us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Black squirrel in a white world with a bushy tail. Tell me all about it. Tell me all about it. Tell me all about it. Black squirrel. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid, GNC, and Duane Reade. This is NPR, National...
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the Extended Golf Challenge, wherein Q stands for qualifying and school stands for nothing. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
And if you won't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Remember that.
Thank you, Mr. Barnum. In the NBA playoffs, the Cavs-Nets series stands at 2-0 Cleveland, and the Detroit Pistons hold a 3-0 lead over Chicago. Wasn't the Eastern Conference supposed to be wide open?
It is wide open if you're Detroit and probably Cleveland. I mean, the wide open portion of the Eastern Conference was who was going to be playing Detroit for the Eastern Conference Championship. And we'd like to thank the Chicago Bulls for playing. They have lovely parting gifts that they won against Miami, but they have no chance against the Pistons at all. I don't know about you, but me and David Stern would both like to see LeBron James in the final. So I would watch the prospective Cleveland-Detroit series with some care.
The NHL's conference finals began on Thursday, Charlie, when the Ottawa Senators beat the Buffalo Sabres. This matchup presents sort of a conundrum for those inclined to root for underdogs. Do you root for the one remaining Canadian team or the team that was almost eliminated from the league because it ran out of money a few years ago?
Well, this is proof positive, once again, that when teams tell you they're out of money, it doesn't matter. They can still win. The Buffalo Sabres are one step away from playing for the Stanley Cup. I root for the Senators because Ottawa was a city that even Canadians didn't want a hockey team in for a long time, and it is, after all, the national capital. And I like, and plus they have that very cool logo that looks like the hood ornament on a 1940s limousine. So I'm going to root for them.
On Thursday, the National Hockey League Players Association fired executive director Ted Saskin, who had been accused of reading players' email. Would Saskin have kept his job if he had bargained for a better collective bargaining agreement 2 years ago?
I think he had a little bit of problem with that. I don't think there was a lot of slack left for him. And this reading the email thing is just flatly bizarre. If you know they're gunning for you, don't set up a stand outside your house and sell them bullets.
I hope Roger Clemens didn't decide to come back to the Yankees so he could enjoy a beer in the clubhouse with his teammates, Charlie, because if he did, I guess he's bound to be disappointed.
Yeah, this is baseball's attempt to... divorce itself once again from the fact that beer has been an integral part of baseball for as long as there's been baseball. I won't be impressed by this policy, of course, until the St. Louis Cardinals move out of the stadium they're in and start playing at Abstemiousness Park.
Ricky Henderson, who is a special instructor with the Mets this year, may have begun a comeback drive just this week, even though he's 48 years old. What encouraged Henderson to think he could still play in the bigs?
He caught a foul ball in the stands, which is something I've never done. I've come within about four or five rows. And a youngster next to him wanted the ball, and Ricky wouldn't give it to him because Ricky caught a foul ball in the stands. So he signed the ball the kid already had, and the kid probably didn't have any idea who Ricky Henderson was. I would keep it, too, if I were him. I mean, catching a foul ball is one of my lifelong dreams, and I simply have never even come close.
In a mea culpa of sorts, Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling characterized his own behavior as reckless this week. WRECKLESS on his blog. Did that mean he hadn't had an automobile accident?
I was going to say, it probably meant that he's not beached himself on a reef anytime soon. No, he ran his mouth on the radio about Barry Bonds and steroids and pointed out Bonds' sorry marital history and sorry history with the Internal Revenue Service. And once again, Curt Schilling behaved like the kind of guy you run across the bar to avoid when the conversation turns to anything serious. This is also the guy, you may recall, who had a chance under oath to talk about steroids after having talked about steroids for years and turtled up pretty badly in front of the United States Congress. So apparently Terry Francona, who doesn't need this with his team seven games ahead of first place and cruising right along, has called everybody together and said, how about we shut up about this for a while?
It's the old Archie Bunker treatment.
Shut up, you.
It's been a strange and unhappy year for the men who broadcast Baltimore Orioles games, Charlie, and not just because the Orioles are not playing especially well. I guess Gary Thorne and Rick Dempsey have to hope bad things don't come in threes.
And I reiterate, shut up, you. Gary Thorne, of course, was the one who blurted out on the air that he thought Curt Schilling's sock had been painted during the famous bloody sock game, and we had a two-week kerfuffle about that. And now Rick Dempsey had the wife of Oriole left fielder Jay Gibbons on, and she was promoting a fundraiser to help fight domestic violence. And Rick Dempsey said he tried to put the left fielder slump together with the fundraiser and said, Laura, will this kind of help Jay in the domestic violence area? If he doesn't start getting a few more hits, you might grab him around the neck and rough him up a little bit. Shut up, you!
It was learned this week that just Tennessee Titans defensive back Adam Pac-Man Jones met on April 3rd with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to appeal his suspension for the entire 2007 season due to misbehavior at a strip club.
No.
The night before the meeting, Jones went to, are you ready? A strip club.
This is what happens when the Guggenheim closes early. Guys don't have any place else to go.
The library
Pac-Man, come on, go to the Blue Note. Go have a hot dog at a soubrette stand on 51st Street when you've been called in to discuss the NFL's displeasure with your activities in strip clubs. Don't go to a strip club! It's National Stupid Week!
There is talk in NFL circles about adding a 17th regular season game to the schedule, and so I guess we learn once again that when it comes to the NFL, more is more.
Much more is more. We're going to move this game like out of the United States of America, too. They're talking about adding a 17th regular season game and playing it outside the United States, which is going to make the various paranoids and mountebanks who coach NFL teams really thrilled, let me tell you. Imagine Bill Belichick determining that he has to play Indianapolis, then he has to get on an airplane and go to Oslo to play the Tennessee Titans the next week.
Floyd Landis claimed this week that a U.S. anti-doping agency lawyer asked him to provide any information that might implicate Lance Armstrong. Why is USADA focusing on a retired bicycle
rider?
Because
this is the way drug warriors do business. USADA is possessed by this kind of messianic fascism about its function and the importance of the great national crisis it's dealing with, and it's knuckling Floyd Landis to give them Lance Armstrong so they can hang Lance Armstrong's head on the walls of their agency so none of them lose their phony baloney jobs. This is the way a war on drugs always works.
And finally, Charlie,
Oh, I love this. Go ahead.
And finally, Charlie, in celebration of the achievement of George Mallory, who may or may not have reached the top of Mount Everest in 1924, a number of climbers bound for that summit will wear 1920s-era clothing on the ascent. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, George Mallory died on Everest, Bill, and they didn't find his body until 1998. For some reason, I think that this probably proves that climbing Mount Everest in hobnail boots, knickerbockers, Burberry suits, and even fur-lined motorcycle helmets is probably not the state of the art.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Stupid week!
Gotta watch the Dodgers win.
Have yourself a dandy.
If you're a member of the Weekend Late Risers Club or find yourself otherwise indisposed when Only a Game hits the conventional airwaves, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. About the middle of his most recent book, Tales from Q School, John Feinstein tells the story of a young golfer who is anxious to step up and attempt a 3-foot putt, even though technically it's not his turn. I hope you won't mind if I finish right now, he tells the two men with whom he's playing, because if I have to wait a couple of minutes, I don't know if I'll be able to grip the club, much less draw it back. This is, according to John Feinstein, a story more likely to happen in Q School, the series of tournaments that determine who will earn the opportunity to play on the PGA Tour, than anywhere else. John Feinstein joins me now in the studio to explain why that is. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be with you again.
Steve Wheatcroft was the player who was afraid that he would lose the ability to even hold on to his putter. Tell me about what he had to gain and what he had to lose on that day.
Well, the putt that I'm describing is on the 18th hole of what's called the second stage of Q School. There are three stages. Most golf fans think of qualifying school. And by the way, it's called school because back in the 60s when it first started, the players didn't make enough money on tour to not hold down a real job. Mm-hmm. So they were club professionals, and there was a two-day classroom aspect to it where you learned to be a small businessman in addition to playing the golf. 1,200 golfers start out playing first stage. 165 get to the finals. 30-plus ties get to the tour. Wheatcroft had never been to the finals, and by getting there, he at least knew he would have a place to play golf for money during the upcoming year, because if he didn't make the tour, he'd be on the AAA nationwide tour.
Once you started exploring the Q School phenomenon, were you surprised at how many of the men who returned to Q School had won tournaments on the PGA Tour?
I was actually shocked when I ran the numbers. In 2005, there were 42 guys between the second stage and the third stage who had won at least once on the PGA Tour. Many of them had won multiple times, including Larry Mize, who won the Masters in 1987 with one of the most famous shots in the history of golf. And kind of one of the funny moments was Mize had to go back to second stage. He wasn't even exempt to the finals. He made it through to the finals, and I was walking around with him one day at the finals. There aren't many fans there, a couple hundred maybe. But someone yelled at him, "Mr. Mize, you don't deserve to be here." And Larry Mize turned and said, no, I do. I made it through second stage to get this far.
You point out that the top pros like to say that playing on the PGA Tour is one of the few jobs where somebody can make more than $500,000 a year and then get fired. Is this an exaggeration?
No, it literally is not, because in 2006, the 125th money winner on the tour made $634,000. Anybody below him had to go back to Q School if he wanted to be fully exempt to play on the tour the next year. So there were guys between $500,000 and $633,000 who had to go back to Q School in order to keep their jobs for the next year.
One of the players you followed, Ryan Geoffrey, explains some of his own failures to earn a tour card by saying, quote, "I just couldn't make myself believe I was good enough to make it." How common is that among players who get as far as qualifying for Q School?
It happens a lot because they're intimidated by, for example, 42 past tournament winners being in the event, or maybe getting paired with a past Masters champion, or guys they recognize who've had success at the college level. And frequently it takes 2, 3, 4 times before you get confident enough to play at the close to your game's potential. Mac O'Grady played at Q School 17 times before he made it to the PGA Tour.
And he must have liked it.
Well, there are some guys who almost do like it. Michael Allen, who's been in the final 16 times, says he just plans his winter vacation around being at Q School. But it is very difficult to convince yourself that you're good enough. And then the flip side comes, Casey Martin, you may remember him, the handicap golfer who sued the PGA Tour to get use of a cart and won in the Supreme Court. He remembered going back for the last time at the age of 33 and looking at the 23-year-olds and saying, "These guys aren't afraid of me. They think they can whip me." And in many cases, of course, they could.
Of several of the older players, and by older, I mean guys in their mid-30s, mid-40s, mm-hmm. that range, who are trying to gain or regain their PGA cards by going through Q School, you write, they were searching for that boyhood feeling that they could do anything. Does that seem kind of sad to you?
Well, it's sad, of course. Loss of innocence is always sad. And if you ever watch a young player, I watch my 13-year-old son sometimes. He knows he's going to make every putt. The thought of missing a putt never crosses his mind. And that's true of young professionals because they haven't failed yet. They've just been on this up escalator. And then they get to the top of the escalator, and then it starts to slide down a little bit. Mm. So, yes, of course, there's a sadness to it. But you understand when someone has been that good and has lived that life, it's a very good life if you do get to the PGA Tour. I call it the courtesy car life because everything is free, that you don't want to give it up until someone comes along and says you've got no choice but to go home.
Much of what happens in Q School has to do with tension and disappointment. Some of the players become physically mm-hmm. ill with the tension of what they're going through. There are plenty of tears. But you did find some guys who actually kind of like playing in the Q School.
Well, my favorite story among those guys was a guy named Ron Whitaker, who had gotten through Q School all the way to the tour when he was 24 years old, and then for the next 10 years couldn't get back to that level. And he finally said to his wife, I'm 34, we're trying to start a family. If I don't make it through second stage this year, because second stage had become a wall for him, he'd missed by one shot four times to get to the finals, I have to get a job. And he goes to second stage, and he plays, and at the end of the last day, he looks at the scoreboard, and he's missed by one shot again. And he's devastated, and he calls his wife, and he says, I'm coming home. We're going to talk about what we're going to do next. And she says, I understand. And he goes back to the hotel, and she calls him and says, honey, my brother just called. He's online. He says, you made it. That's impossible, because two guys in the last group would have had to shoot close to 80 for me to have any chance. I'm telling you what he says. He has no computer with him. He's in a Holiday Inn Express. He goes down to the manager, gets him to get on the computer so he can get online. Sure enough, two guys in the last group shot 78. He made it on the number. He calls his wife, and she says, oh, that's great news. This is as good a time as any to tell you I'm pregnant. So talk about your life changing in 5 minutes. And I said to him at the finals, I said, do you sleep okay? He says, I have no trouble sleeping. And Ambien and Pepto-Bismol is my dinner every night, and I sleep like a baby.
It's almost possible, hearing some of these stories, to feel sorry for the tiny number of golfers who've never had the Q School experience, the Tiger Woods and a few others of the world who were simply so good that they moved right into the big leagues.
Right. You know, all kidding aside, Tom Watson, great player, obviously winner of 8 majors, who went through Q School, said that he thinks of Q School as a rite of passage as a golfer. He's very proud of the fact that he went to Q School, that he succeeded the first time. He remembers that week as vividly as any in golf, including the weeks when he won major championships. And he actually said that Tiger, Phil Mickelson, Justin Leonard, Greg Norman, guys like that who did skip Q School, missed something. And in fact, other players will tell you that when you sit around the locker room during a rain delay, everybody tells Q School stories, and those guys are left out.
All right, John, I know that you are a golfer, and I'm curious. Has writing 4 books about golf, not counting a novel set in golf, improved your game?
Not even a little bit. If anything else, when I watch these guys play, it reminds me that they are playing an entirely different game. You remember what Bobby Jones once said of Jack Nicklaus? He plays a game with which I'm not familiar.
I remember.
They all play a game with which I'm not familiar.
John Feinstein is the author of Tales from Q School, published by Little Brown. He joined me here in the studio. John, thanks very much for speaking
with
me.
Thanks for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Maggie Haskins. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view a badminton photo gallery, learn more about Tales from Q School, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Paula Bachner, the mother of twin high school badminton players.
We're looking for colleges that might have badminton, and they're few and far between.
Well, it's the wrong country, but travel is broadening, and perhaps Indonesia's Shuttlecock University might be an avenue to explore. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org.